Welcome to Let's Talk Fleet Risk, a podcast for those who manage drivers and vehicles and want to reduce road risk in their organisation. In this episode, I'm talking to Alison Moriarty about leadership in road risk management. We'll be discussing the difference between leading and managing, how to get buy-in from senior leaders, the impact leadership has on safety culture, the importance of managing reputational risk, and how all of this can impact the organisation's financial performance. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the October edition of Let's Talk Fleet Risk. My guest this week is one of the most experienced, multi-award-winning fleet risk professionals that I know and has managed driver safety for a huge range of fleets over many years. She's now Fleet Risk Director for Matrix IQ, helping companies to identify and mitigate risk. My guest today is Alison Moriarty. Welcome to the podcast, Alison.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
So, Alison, when I wanted to talk to someone about the importance of leadership in driver safety and how to engage leaders, you were the first person I thought of. We've known each other for many years now. You've got a mammoth amount of experience that I'm looking forward to delving into. So thanks for coming on the show. Perhaps you could start by giving us just a potted history of how you came to be involved in managing work-related road risk and driver safety, and maybe a sort of an idea of the sorts of fleet and risk that you've managed.
Will do. First of all, just let me pick you up on a mammoth amount of experience, Simon, which is, I think, a term for old, is it not? But we'll let that slide. So I started in health, safety, environment and quality. That was my qualification and what I was really passionate about. And I worked in companies that were utilities, construction, civil engineering. So that was kind of my background. And one day I sat with one of our fleet managers talking about, you know, we were doing really well, winning RoSPA prizes because our safety record was so good. And we started to talk about the amount of collisions we were having and the sort of damage we were having to vehicles. And I was absolutely flabbergasted because if that had been on-site accidents, we'd never probably pick up another contract. You know, it was that different in terms of the parity that we put on safety on site and on road. So that's kind of why I then decided to specialise and actually start to look at fleet safety as a speciality.
You mentioned a couple of industries there, which you would typically view as sort of hazardous industries.
Yes.
Do you see any difference in approach for companies that are already in a hazardous industry to those that aren't?
Unfortunately, I wouldn't say that in looking at on-road safety, there is a massive difference. And I think that's because there are so many general health and safety risks that the health and safety teams tend to concentrate on those on-site and operational things, and maybe not looking at driving as a work activity. And they probably think, well, the fleet managers will deal with that. And of course, there's that risk then that the fleet managers think, oh, that's safety, so health and safety will look at that. And I think that's probably one of the biggest problems that as an industry we encounter. So I don't think there is a massive difference. I think maybe once people in those sort of hazardous industries identify it, then maybe they've got more of a resource and more of a background to then start tackling the risks. But in terms of people doing it well, sort of from day one, I don't really think there is a massive difference, to be honest.
Now, we talk a lot about managing risk and safety, and you mentioned in that answer that quite often that sort of management role can be shared between different job roles. So companies who perform well in this area, they've always seemed to have really strong leaders at the top. There are people at the top who really get behind the program. So I was wondering, what's the difference between simply managing road risk and providing strong leadership in road risk?
I think it's the same in anything that you do as a company. I think leadership is such a different role than being a manager. So I think a manager, it's quite perfunctory and it's these things need to be done. Whereas I think as a leader, it's more about a thought process. It's more about an ethos and, you know, making sure that there's something in the industry that you're working in that you can be identified as somebody who has views on this, has views on, you know, what that culture is like. So I think that's really, really important. And I think also being a leader doesn't just mean, make, you know, saying, all right, we need to do this, we need to do that. It's not just about process. It's also about making sure things are inclusive and that things are equitable, setting the tone, all those sort of things. And I think if you're a leader, one of the things you absolutely have to do, and I'm sure we'll talk about this a bit later as well, is be identifiable as, you know, actually portraying those things yourself. And I think that's really important. A leader has to demonstrate that they believe and that they deliver what it is they're expecting everybody else to do.
Yeah, leading by example is critical, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Into that in a few moments. So one of the things I've sometimes found, there's a temptation to forget driver safety or to fail to understand it's important. And, you know, usually that's not malicious. It's just that general business operations or running the organisation can assume more importance or urgency, just as a kind of day-to-day running of the business. So tell me about your experience working with senior leaders in your previous roles and what drove them to take it seriously or to not take it seriously if there were that kind of instance.
So I think I've been quite fortunate in that the businesses that I've worked in have always had a very strong safety culture and safety focus and had really good leadership around that. What they didn't necessarily have is what you touched on, is that same approach to on-road safety. But where having somebody who has the approach in general health and safety helps is that once they've got that message, then they understand and they can, you know, they can portray that as being as important as anything else. And I think, you know, I've, like I say, I have been very lucky and safety has been the main focus for most of the leaders I've worked with. But I think one thing when you're trying to instill this into any sort of company is to be able to identify people's motivators. And obviously, I would love the only motivator to have to be people getting home safely at the end of the day. That's the dream. But don't be afraid if somebody is much more financially focused, then, you know, we're going to talk about reputational and financial risk later, financial benefits. Don't be afraid to use that. You know, if you can't get through just on the safety angle, then it's about understanding those people and what makes them tick, and then going in from that angle. And there is always an angle. You know, there is always a way to get through to somebody and get them to realize just how important this is for their organization.
A great way of demonstrating leadership is to create a statement that demonstrates your commitment to managing road risk and driver safety. You can do this on the Driving for Better Business website and then download a PDF that you can share with everyone in your organisation as well as clients and suppliers. There's a link in the show notes. Let's talk a little bit about safety culture. So we both know lots of companies where senior leaders get it and take an active role in promoting road safety for staff, and they have really good risk management programs in place. And as you just said, you've been lucky enough to work for some of those companies. But we also both know that many people responsible for driver safety aren't necessarily at board level, and they might struggle to get buy-in from everyone that they need to put an appropriate program in place. So if that support isn't there, surely that kills any chance of a strong safety culture, doesn't it? What does safety culture mean to you, and why should drivers care if leaders don't?
Well, I think that's absolutely the crucial thing there, Simon, that people, you know, if you're a driver and you go into a company, you will get a safety induction for all the things you do on site. You know, they'll check your tickets if you need to use any sort of plant machinery. But if nobody's doing a driver induction, and that's part of your role, if nobody is setting the standard for you and saying, this is what we expect, this is what we don't expect, then of course you won't care. And I think, you know, one thing you identified there that I think is really, really important is if you're sort of a bit further down the chain, so you're not necessarily the one making the decision, you might struggle sometimes to build that safety culture. But I think going to people with some facts, getting people on board, like your safety teams, people like that, to then push that message and to try and get that wider in the organisation. You know, there are, as I said, there are financial things, but there are also, you know, general duty of care, health and safety legislation, which covers driving as much as anything else. So I think having those sort of conversations and making sure that drivers understand, you know what, guys, we do care what you're doing. It's not just a mobile toolbox. Driving is a work activity. It's part of what you do. And we need to know that you're doing it safely. And I think you can start that at any level. You know, it's always better from the top. It's always better to have leadership buy-in, because I think people then do go, oh, actually they care. But do you know what? Even if you manage three drivers and you talk to those drivers, explain that it's important, explain what's expected, that can have a ripple effect through an organisation when you start showing things like, oh yeah, we're having less collisions, we're saving money on SMI costs, and we'll go into all that later. But I do think there are ways and means of getting that message throughout and building that culture, no matter where you sit, as long as you're passionate about it.
What are some of the things that you would do to try and develop a strong and safe driving culture within a business then? And I guess with some of these examples as well, they can take a long time to sort of build that trust and with the drivers and to build that safety culture. And it can be so easily undone very quickly indeed, can't it, with the wrong thoughts. So how would you sort of look to develop a safe driving culture?
I think the first thing is something I've just mentioned, and that is your day one. So as soon as somebody comes into your organisation who's going to drive, do a driver induction with them. Make sure they've had a driving licence check before they get in a vehicle. Do a basic eyesight check. All the things that make that person think, oh, okay, so the driving's important here. So I think that's the first thing, is to start from day one properly. And then I think it's making sure that you put training in, because it's all about that investment, isn't it, in people. So, you know, we do all sorts of compulsory training as part of our jobs. You know, we do modern slavery training, inclusion training, all these things that are really important. But how many companies do specific training around driving? And I don't necessarily mean in cab skills based here, because I don't think that's necessarily what makes a difference. People know how to drive, they've passed the test. It's about them choosing to do the right thing every time they get behind the wheel. So it's got to be something that's trickle-down approach. It comes from managers. Drivers then understand that's important. It's got to be a consistent message. So, you know, if I drive, Dave's my manager, and he says, you know, look, you've been speeding, we need to talk about this. And then I'm working for Roger on the next shift, and he's like, oh, just get there, mate, we need the job done. That never works. And in terms of breaking a culture, that is one of the worst things, is getting those mixed messages and not being consistent across the piece. But I think really important is that I'm a driver, and I know that what I do, regardless of whatever other job it is I do, I know that people are looking at that because they know it's the highest risk work activity I will probably do, even in construction, even in civil engineering. That's the highest risk, and they want me to be safe. And actually, as a driver, I want to get home safe at the end of the day. And that's how you build a culture.
Alison, we talked earlier about the safety reasons for managing road risk, about it the right thing to do, something I call the moral imperative. But there are significant business reasons why leaders would want driver safety to be managed effectively.
Yeah.
one of the key reasons I come across is management of reputational risk. There can be both negative and positive aspects to this. So how should we view management of reputational risk?
Well, I think, you know, today probably more than ever, when I first started in the industry, there wasn't really the kind of social media, well, not as much of it around, certainly. You have some sort of collision on a motorway and you've got a liveried vehicle, then whether that's actually been your fault or not, that's what people are seeing. That's the clip on YouTube. You know, these are the sort of things that come up all over social media. And, you know, you really run the risk of being tried in the court of public opinion, because all people will see is your liveried vehicle. You've maybe taken out another vehicle or whatever it is you've done. So it's really difficult and it's really dangerous for a company to be seen to be driving poorly and have poor driver behaviours. You know, also people who are cut up or, you know, there was an awful thing on LinkedIn the other week about a driver who, I don't know if you saw the footage, Simon, but he kind of cut somebody up. And then when this person had pumped the horn at him, he'd actually spat at the vehicle. So there are all those sort of things. Now, that person isn't judging that driver. That was a liveried vehicle. And that person is judging that company, because that's what we do in our head. So it's really important that you're seen to be safe on the road. And in terms of that reputational damage, not just about what people think, it's about the effect on your business. So, you know, quite a lot of us and all the companies I've ever worked for tender for contracts. So part of your tender process, of course, safety is a really big part of that. And if you've got a reputation of being, oh, the driver's out from the Wild West and all this sort of thing, then that is going to damage. Certainly if you're looking for working for big organisations and big companies. Also, kind of the opposite of that is if you're reducing collisions and you've got a really good safety program and you can show the improvements of your fleet, that's great. Be vocal about it, shout about it, because that raises the profile of your company. And for the very same reasons that it can hinder you if you're a badly performing company, can also be a really good positive force. People out there thinking, oh yeah, I saw them, they won an award for driver safety, didn't they? That sticks in people's minds as well. And I think the last one around that particular topic is about internal. So it's that internal reputation. And that's about, you know, driver retention and driver recruitment, because a lot of drivers, although they might sometimes think like, oh, people watching what I'm doing. Actually, if you're putting training into drivers and you know, you can show them that this is something we care about, they're actually much more likely to stay with you. And recruitment and retention, we know what in the driving community, that's actually quite a difficult task at the moment. So it just, all that kind of helps from a reputational internal and external.
And we've both spoken to drivers who've worked for companies that have won those sorts of awards for driver safety. And they get a real pride out of it, don't they? Because they genuinely feel that they've contributed to something, and they start to feel pride that and understand that the driving is a part of the job. It's not ancillary to the job. It's part of the job, and it needs to be done to the same high standard as whatever it is, their skill or trade or whatever is. And they get genuine satisfaction from that, don't they?
They do. And I think, you know, that when we were talking about safety culture before, that just then becomes business as usual. And that is the absolute panacea. Once that, you know, lowering the risk and improving driver behaviour becomes business as usual, that is much more likely to keep a driver there in your company. And like you say, you know, it doesn't have to be massive financial rewards for drivers for driving safely. They do like to be part of success, like we all do. You know, it's a great thing, and it reflects well on everybody.
Yeah. And you mentioned in there as well, greater success for when tendering for contracts, which is a particular sort of passion of ours at Driving for Better Business at the moment, because we're of it as a campaign program. We're run by National Highways, and they now demand evidence that their supply chains are managing work-related road risk. We're working with the rail sector now to do a similar sort of thing. So, you know, if you don't manage it well, you run the risk of losing out on future work. But equally, it's an ideal opportunity for you to ensure higher standards down through your own supply chain, and to work with higher quality companies as well, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. And I think, you know, one particular company I worked with was absolutely the best at this I've ever come across. And, you know, we had a supply chain school, and part of that was a big safety aspect of it. So if we had suppliers who maybe had some gaps in some areas, we would happily put them on our training programs. We didn't charge for that. And I think that's something that if you're a bigger company with a bigger resource, yes, you absolutely have the duty to make sure that you've done your due diligence and the people who are driving on your behalf are safe. But also, you probably have the resource that they don't have to maybe include them in some of the things you do. And I think this is where, you know, your driver for better business, the resources, I think, you know, they're absolutely priceless, because people don't necessarily have that skill in a smaller company. But if you've got all that advice there ready, you know, ready to just pick up and run with, then, you know, that should be something that larger companies are really pushing down through their supply chain.
Now, you mentioned earlier about some of the financial benefits that come from good management, and how these can be used as part of a business case to go and engage senior leadership as well, if that's required. Now, the Driving for Better Business website contains many case studies showing how companies have controlled costs or reduced environmental impact. And you've created some of these case studies for us in the past with some of the employers that you've worked for. So talk us through some of the financial benefits that come from this.
So I think the first one, which is probably an obvious one, is collision damage. And that's, you know, own vehicle or third party. So a lot of companies' insurances are they're self-insured for their own vehicles, quite a number of large companies. So they're picking up all the crash damage, but also then, of course, with your third parties that are involved in collisions. There's a huge cost there, and things like, you know, replacement vehicles, and vehicles are very difficult to get hold of at the minute, will get harder and harder the bigger your electric side of the fleet gets. So there's that, and that is, you know, tens and tens of thousands of pounds, depending on the size of fleet. And obviously, kind of a natural consequence of that as well is looking at your insurance renewals. So if you can show that you've got a good risk program in place, you can show you're reducing collisions. Not only can you talk to your existing insurer about maybe looking at either not increasing or actually decreasing your premium, that's brilliant. But also what it does is it gives you a much wider choice. So one of the fleets I worked with, we had two insurers who we kind of flipped between. Then we had one, and that one was thinking about, do it right, we'll reinsure you this time, but we don't know next time, because we were missing our loss ratio by quite some distance. By the time we'd done an 18-month program, I first started doing the fleet risk and really getting into it, we'd seven insurers vying for our business the next time it came around. And that, of course, gives you all those advantages of being able to compare and to actually say, oh, well, you know, we've been offered this. And so there are big savings to be made there. SMR cost. So we've reduced this by absolutely, probably the most was probably about 34-35%, but that's all your service, maintenance, repair, which we've already kind of mentioned repair. But, you know, people aren't going through the same amount of brake pads. They're not knocking the wing mirrors all the time because they're being more careful. They're not having as many tyres fitted to a vehicle. So you can actually look at that correlation between improved driver behaviour and your SMI costs. And that's what we do for some of our clients. And it's, you know, it's a really strong correlation. So there's that. There's obviously fuel consumption, vehicles driven better, driven more safely, use less fuel. So that's a huge one, because, you know, an outlay to most companies with big fleets, probably the biggest outlay for that fleet is the fuel. So actually looking at being able to reduce that, hugely important to any fleet, really. And then, you know, if you hire vehicles, which lots of fleets purely hire or do a mix of the two, off hire damage, I mean, that I used to absolutely dread it when it was coming to a period where we'd a massive part of the fleet coming off hire to bring new vehicles in, because the off hire damage that people hadn't reported, again, poor culture, if the culture's good, people report. But then at the end, you've got this huge sum of money to pay out that you've not even considered. So that's a big one. But I think also, you know, I mentioned driver retention and recruitment before. It's a hugely costly business to bring new drivers in. A, to recruit them, to make sure they're the right drivers, then to go through all the checks and balances you need to do, and then to train them and get them into your culture. So, you know, what by keeping drivers with you, you're even cutting down on all those sort of costs. So that is probably the tip of the iceberg. There are probably loads more, but I think they're probably kind of the biggest ones in terms of monetary saving.
Many organisations have shared case studies with us that demonstrate where they've been able to control costs better as a direct result of more effective risk management and consequent reductions in collisions. They're on the Driving for Better Business website in the resources section, and you'll find a link in the show notes. One of the reasons I see companies not achieving these benefits, especially around things like SMR costs, is that often they're looking in the wrong place, because a lot of them get simply written off as the cost of doing business. So they get aggregated and sort of put onto one line in a spreadsheet each month as, you know, SMR costs for the fleet. And they don't sometimes get marked against specific drivers or vehicles. And this to me is a really missed opportunity to spot unnecessarily high costs. As well as an indicator that a specific driver might be a higher risk and might need some intervention, isn't it?
It is. And I think probably from my kind of past, the example I'd give you of this is that I did have a particular director, a divisional director, who, when I first started introducing things in a particular company, wasn't interested. So we talked about safety, we talked about, you know, SMR costs and fuel, and it didn't mean anything to him. He just wasn't that interested. And I remember, you'd probably be aware of the kind of Nestle case that they did, which was to cost out how many Kit Kats did you produce every year to pay for the crash damage. And I did something similar. There was a particular gang in this division who were having lots and lots of issues, driving really badly, speeding, getting parking fines, you know, reversing into things. And he didn't want to touch them because he said, they're my best gang, they're my most productive gang. So I didn't argue. I went away, did a lot of research, came back and sat down with him and said, that gang doesn't make you any money from January to the end of June to pay for their crash damage and excess fuel. And all of a sudden we were having a very different conversation. And I think you're right, you know, just a figure on a piece of paper that can be tucked away under something doesn't necessarily give the picture. And I think it's about making it real to people, you know, and having the guts to pull it out and say, no, I'm not going to be ignored on this because this is really important, you know. And if this was people getting compensation for falls from heights, we'd be looking into it really seriously. And this is more serious even than that. So, you know, I'm going to carry on beating that drum. Not saying you'll always be popular, Simon. Don't think I always have been, but I've always been very persistent. And I think eventually you do get the message through.
And that last point sort of brings us back to what we were discussing at the start about engaging senior leadership, because lots of people, if they don't have any sort of normal impact on the drivers, if they don't come into contact with the driving side of the business that much, then you've got to try and be creative about how you form that message so that it will engage them. So if it's a sales manager, for instance, or an operations manager, and they're just forcing sort of unrealistic work schedules or demands on the drivers, then they're not going to understand about the more crashes, or they might not be interested in it. But if you can turn that into convert that the cost of all those incidents into, well, actually, you've got to sell this amount more stuff, that's got to go your target to cover this. And if we didn't have all these incidents, you'd have find a much easier job meeting sales targets or productivity targets. That's a really good way of getting people's attention, isn't it?
It is. And also, one thing that I would say, if you're trying to introduce this and to get the kind of that management level involved in it, start putting it in the performance reviews. We review every other aspect of how somebody does the job. So if I'm managing a team, you know, the productivity of it and all these sort of things will be looked at. How are they driving and what am I doing about it? And actually start putting KPIs in, you know, and actually doing it as part of the performance review. How many collisions have your drivers had? What are you doing about it? And I think that really, again, just reinforces the fact that this is a work activity and something you have to manage. So, yeah, there are lots of ways, but I think making it tangible to somebody definitely is the most effective.
Yeah, and the bit about performance reviews makes it more accountable as well. So,
yeah.
My final question for you, Alison, is a single piece of advice for the audience. So thinking back on what we've just discussed and what good leadership means to you, where do you think people should focus their attention first? What's the most important thing to get right first to ensure a strong safety culture and to start realising some of the benefits we've talked about?
So I think lots of people probably listen to this will have heard this in one guise or another. It's something that in the safety community we use quite a bit. But I think it's absolutely the most important thing for people to take from this about leadership and how to make it work. And that is that as a leader, the lowest standard of safety that you portray and accept from others is the highest standard that your organisation will give you back. And I think if you take nothing else away, take that away.
Excellent advice. I'm going to put Alison's contact details in the show notes, along with links to some of the leadership resources from the Driving for Better Business website that you might find useful. So thank you, everyone, for listening. And Alison, thank you so much for sharing your insights with me today.
Always a pleasure, Simon. Thank you.
Brought to you by Driving for Better Business.